Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Dreyfuss, author and contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who examines the deadly consequences of Israel's disproportionate bombing of Palestinians in Gaza and the rising international pressure to reach a ceasefire. An excerpt of a speech by anti-fracking activist Sandra Steingraber at the First National Protest Rally against fracked natural gas exports from a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal in Maryland and other sites nationwide. And Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, who discusses a Chilean court ruling which found that the U.S. government was complicit in the murder of two American citizens in Chile during the Washington-backed military coup there in 1973. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Australia was temporarily blocked from deporting 153 asylum seekers back to Sri Lanka, where advocates say they face persecution. While the Australia High Court considers the case, the refugees remain on an Australian ship at sea. During a court hearing, Australia's Immigration Minister Scott Morrison disclosed that 41 Sri Lankans intercepted on a different boat had been returned to Sri Lanka, where they were arrested for leaving the Southeast Asian nation illegally. Sri Lanka has been harshly criticized for its human rights record since its two-decade civil war with the Tamil Tigers ended in 2009. During a hearing before the High Court in Melbourne, Morrison promised to give the court 72 hours' notice before the 153 asylum seekers are returned to Sri Lanka. For now, the detainees will remain at sea for an indefinite period of time. Australian prosecutor Justin Gleeson insisted the Sri Lankans have no rights under the Migration Act since they were detained in international waters. Refugee advocates left the hearing hopeful that the High Court would give the Sri Lankans an opportunity to seek asylum in Australia. However, Sarah Hanson-Young, the immigration spokesperson with the Australian Green Party, declared, "The ugly truth is that the government has been detaining dozens of children out on the high seas. It's time for the government to accept the fact that what they are doing is morally wrong." Today, Port Arthur, Texas, has become ground zero in the battle to stop global warming. The formerly thriving African-American community, surrounded by oil refineries and petrochemical plants, is now battling high unemployment and an outbreak of respiratory diseases linked to air pollution, such as asthma. Next to Port Arthur's Carver Terrence housing development sit two large oil refineries owned by Valero and Motiva. Community activists organized a campaign to oppose a bid by Motiva to double the size of its refinery's capacity to 600,000 barrels of oil a day. But while the refinery prevailed, a local grassroots group, the Community In Power and Development Association, won international recognition for successfully pressuring the refineries to install state-of-the-art air filters and fund a new community health center for Port Arthur residents. With its fossil fuel pollution and the destructive force of recent hurricanes from Katrina and Rita to Ike, Port Arthur is a clear example of how the poor and disenfranchised are bearing a disproportionate burden of the cost of climate change. The National Park Service has issued a warning about a proposed development project within view of the south rim of the Grand Canyon. The Navajo Indian Tribal Government has recently unveiled plans for a theme park with restaurants and a gondola bringing tourists down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. A second proposed development near the entrance of the canyon's south rim would build over 2,000 new homes and 3 million square feet of commercial retail space. The National Park Service sees these plans as the most serious threat Grand Canyon Park has faced in its 95-year history. Combined, the development projects would endanger the national beauty of the canyon, encroach on its borders, and jeopardize the fragile ecology and water supply on the arid South Rim Plateau. For now, the National Park Service is waiting to see a full development plan from the Navajo Tribal Council before offering an official response. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The ongoing conflict between Israel and the Hamas government in Gaza, which erupted in the wake of the murder of three Israeli teenagers and the revenge killing of a 16-year-old Palestinian boy, has been costly. More than 193 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed, with nearly 80% of the dead civilians and more than 20% children, according to a July 14th report issued by the United Nations Office of Humanitarian Affairs. The UN also reported that over 1,300 Palestinians have sustained injuries as a result of Israel's bombardment. Although it's claimed that more than 700 rockets have been fired from Gaza into Israel, as of July 15th, only one Israeli civilian has been reported killed, with a dozen more injuries. Israel asserts that Hamas is using civilians as human shields in Gaza by deploying rockets and military posts in residential areas. Gaza hospitals are reporting a dire shortage of medicine and equipment, and the territory's water utility has suspended operations due to the conflict, placing the water supply for 600,000 people at risk. Some 17,000 Palestinians in northern Gaza have fled their homes following Israeli warnings of impending airstrikes. After the failure of a proposed Egyptian ceasefire plan on July 15th, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that Israel's military would intensify its offensive against Hamas in Gaza, possibly signaling an imminent ground invasion. Your reporter spoke with Robert Dreyfus, author and contributing editor with The Nation magazine. Here he examines the deadly consequences of Israel's disproportionate bombing of Palestinians in Gaza as international pressure grows to reach a ceasefire.
It's a hellish place, Gaza. There's no easy way to get in or out. The economy virtually doesn't exist. You've got a huge Palestinian population that lives virtually in a prison camp there. And the Israelis and the United States both say that they won't talk to Gaza unless Hamas changes its spots and recognizes Israel and agrees to treat Israel as if it were an ordinary country. And the Hamas leadership is very, very reluctant to do that. So, yes, there was some incidents recently involving some teenagers on both sides who were kidnapped and brutally murdered by their respective kidnappers. And once again, we see an escalation. I mean, I don't think it serves much purpose to look at these proximate causes of who did what to these poor teenagers. The fact of the matter is that this eruption, this latest one, followed a nine-month-long effort by Secretary of State Kerry to try to find a negotiated opening, or at least for a solution between Israel and the Palestinians, and unfortunately got no place. And I would say got no place because the current leadership in Israel is simply unwilling to envision a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. They have, for strategic and religious biblical reasons, decided that the West Bank in particular, which is occupied by Israel, you know, is and should be permanently part of the state of Israel. And so they're not willing to retreat or give it up. They've got at least 500,000 Jewish settlers who've filled in huge parts of the West Bank. And it's an intractable problem as long as Israel isn't willing to pull back and give the Palestinians what they're asking for. So the current fighting in Gaza is just, you know, the most extreme manifestation of that conflict.
I think it warrants comment on the disproportionate nature of the current battle being waged by Israel against Hamas in Gaza. It's often discussed how asymmetrical this conflict is at the present, with almost 200 Palestinians dying and hundreds more injured.
Yeah, well, you know, Israel is really the superpower of the area. They've got an enormous military with extremely high technological capabilities, and the Palestinians have nothing but, you know, some homemade rockets and some other devices that they can use in this fight. So it really isn't a military contest. That's why it's kind of foolish and foolhardy for the Palestinians to think that, you know, military action is going to advance their cause. I noticed in New York Times the other day it mentioned that of the Israeli casualties, it said there were 120 injuries on the Israeli side, 100 of which at least were Israelis being treated for anxiety, which is almost too terrible a comment to take seriously. I mean, being treated for anxiety while scores of Palestinians are being blown up in their homes, Israel bombing a beach cafe and killing Palestinians where they were watching the World Cup, bombing a mosque to try to kill supposedly one terrorist that they were targeting and killing a couple of dozen innocent Palestinians who were coming out of the mosque. I mean, on and on, there's cases like this of people's homes being destroyed. So, you know, calling it disproportional, I think, understates the problem. That's true with Israel's actions against Gaza, the West Bank, into Lebanon in the past, you know, going back for decades now. That's been the case where the last war in Lebanon, I believe, started when two Israeli soldiers were killed at the border. And a couple of weeks later, there were at least 1,000 Palestinians and Lebanese dead. So, yeah, it's disproportional. That's because Israel can do it. And there's nobody willing to stand up and say that this is wrong, at least nobody with any significant clout who can restrain the Israelis. And that really starts in Washington.
Who gains by this violence? Is there any particular party involved here that gains from all this death and destruction?
Well, I can't see any winners. The Israelis certainly cannot militarily eliminate the political challenge from the Palestinians. That's impossible. The Palestinians certainly can't win because they're vastly outgunned and they don't have either the economic or political clout to resist what Israel is trying to do. So I can't imagine there's any winners in this. It's just the winner is the status quo, which has been going on now in terms of the occupation since 1967, and the status quo persists, and there's no prospect on the horizon for any kind of two-state solution or any kind of settlement that could end this war.
That was Robert Dreyfuss, contributing editor with The Nation magazine and author of the book Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. For more analysis and commentary on the decades-long conflict between Israel and Palestine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 13th, 2,000 people turned out in Washington, D.C. to protest the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC's, likely approval of a liquefied natural gas export facility in Cove Point, Maryland. The LNG port was originally built as an import terminal before fracking led to vastly increased natural gas production, which companies hope to export to consumers worldwide. Protesters in Washington voiced opposition to what they called FERC's rubber stamping of big energy projects. The director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, the group which organized the rally, asserted that the commission has never denied a permit for a large-scale electrical or gas project. The Cove Point, Maryland terminal, owned by Dominion Energy, is located in a middle-class community on the shores of Chesapeake Bay. If the proposed conversion from an import-to-export terminal is approved, critics say many more heavy industry components will be built, increasing the likelihood of an accident, such as a deadly vapor cloud. Protesters gathered on the National Mall for a rally before winding through the streets of the Capitol to the offices of FERC. The morning after the protest action, 24 activists were arrested when they engaged in civil disobedience, blocking the entrances to the building and the parking garage. The activists' goal in the action was to raise the stakes while raising awareness of the issue among the general public and FERC employees. Sandra Steingraber, one of the speakers at the protest rally in Washington, is a biologist, author, and anti-fracking activist from New York State, which has thus far managed to maintain a fracking moratorium. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the July 13th rally and recorded the following excerpt of Steingraber's speech.
We New Yorkers against fracking pledge our support, our assistance, and our solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Maryland who are fighting the LNG terminal in Cove Point. Our destinies are intertwined. Our success depends on yours. Now let me tell you about another small community in New York State. It's called Rossville, and it's located on Staten Island. When you go to Rossville, the first thing you see are two hulking, 10 stories tall tanks that cast a shadow over the whole community. They are 40 years old and they are empty. They have always been empty. They are rusting and birds now fly in and out of them. They were built to hold LNG, but they were never filled with LNG. Why? Because the actions of a community group in Rossville called Bring Legal Action to Stop Tanks. The acronym is BLAST. BLAST worked for 13 years to close those tanks down. Among the leaders of that community group were Gene Cosgriff and his wife, Edwina. Their house was located right next to one of these tanks. They knew that they would be instantly vaporized if an explosion occurred there. So why didn't they just move? Because Gene and Edwina had 18 children and very little money. Their church had helped them to find this house, and they knew they had no alternative but to plant their flag and fight. Gene and Edwina Cosgrove spent 13 years protesting, testifying, and attending every public hearing, and they were compelled to redouble their efforts in February 1973 when another LNG tank on Staten Island's northwest shore blew up, crushing 40 workers to death. The firefighters on the scene said the resulting fire was something out of Dante's Inferno. That explosion mobilized thousands of Staten Islanders to begin a fight to ensure a similar disaster would never happen again. So thanks to their work, we have a ban on LNG in New York State. My friends, the baton that Gene and Edwina Cosgrove carried in 1973 has been passed to us. And what has changed since the terrible LNG conflagration that killed 40 Staten Islanders 40 years ago? Nothing about the inherent hazards of LNG has changed. LNG is still a cryogenic fluid that must be stored at minus 259 degrees Fahrenheit. LNG will still flash freeze human tissue on contact. LNG is still heavier than air and will slither down drainage and sewer pipes and spread underground. And as it disperses, an LNG vapor cloud will still be combustible. LNG is still a known terrorist target. And as in 1973, an LNG fire is not extinguishable by any known firefighting technique. But here is what is different. In 1973, we didn't know yet about climate change. In 1973, we had never heard about fracking. Our stakes are so much higher today. So as we go about our work to do for Cove Point what the people of Rossville and Staten Island did for New York, we have something else to say, and it is this. To the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and to President Obama, we say we are not willing to blow up the bedrock of our nation in order to extract the fossil fuel called methane that will in turn blow up our climate. And we are not willing to liquefy the results using more fossil fuels and so give methane a passport to foreign markets and so further entrench a fossil fuel dependency around the globe in a time of climate emergency. We say no to that.
That was Sandra Steingraber, a biologist, author, and activist with the group New Yorkers Against Fracking, speaking at a July 13th protest rally in Washington, D.C. Learn more about opposition to fracking and LNG export terminals by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Many Americans are unaware of their government's involvement in a host of Cold War-era coup d'états, targeting nations mostly in the developing world that were viewed as allies of the Soviet Union and a threat to U.S. national security. One of those nations was Chile, where a moderate socialist, Salvador Allende, was democratically elected as president in 1970. Then U.S. President Richard Nixon and his Secretary of State Henry Kissinger supported a plan to overthrow Allende's government by backing a military coup launched by Chilean General Augusto Pinochet. After Pinochet seized power on September 11, 1973, Allende was killed or committed suicide, and thousands of suspected leftists were rounded up, with many being tortured or killed. Among those who were murdered by the U.S.-backed regime were two U.S. citizens, 31-year-old filmmaker Charles Horman and 24-year-old student Frank Teruggi, who were both living in Chile during the coup. Horman's wife and parents' search for answers about his disappearance was the subject of the Academy Award-winning 1982 movie Missing, starring Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. Now 40 years after their deaths, a Chilean court issued a ruling on June 30th that found the U.S. government was complicit in the murders of Horman and Teruggi by providing Chile's military information that led to the orders for their execution. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of the book The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Here he assesses the significance of the Chilean court decision, both for Chile and current U.S. foreign policy.
It's always been a question why these two Americans, out of the hundreds of Americans who were in Chile at the time, were not only detained, but then executed at the National Stadium. They are two of more than 1,200 casualties, killings, executed in the weeks and months following the U.S.-supported coup on 9/11/1973. And for years, their families have been pushing to find out what happened to them. 40 years have gone by since they were killed, and 14 years has gone by since the families started court proceedings in Chile in a hope that investigative detectives and the judge would find out what actually happened to them. And that process has taken a significant step forward in recent days.
Peter, what's the evidence that was presented in court that pushed the judges to rule that the United States was responsible for these two murders of these U.S. citizens?
The evidence that the judge has presented is not actually evidence so far. He has made a ruling in which he has made a number of assertions. More than two years ago, he indicted a U.S. military official named Captain Ray Davis, who had been head of U.S. military group in Chile at the time, and who'd crossed paths with Charles Horman. Davis had an office on the floor of the Chilean military intelligence building, and the judge's argument was that he headed a team of U.S. intelligence officers who had gathered information on Americans in Chile and had passed that information to the Chileans. And in passing derogatory, hostile information about Frank Teruggi and about Charles Horman to the Chilean military, U.S. officials had been complicit in targeting those two, not only for arrest, but eventually for execution. The argument is not that we executed them or that we told the Chileans to execute them, it's simply that the U.S. officials put Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi on the radar screen of the Chilean military by passing information about their leftist activities to the Chileans. What the evidence is that U.S. officials did pass that information is hard to know. We haven't seen the judge's investigative files. In his various rulings and indictments, he has made these assertions without actually citing the actual documentation that he has. We do know that in the case of Frank Teruggi, he came across a radar screen of the CIA and the FBI, not in Chile originally, but in Germany, where there was a lot of anti-war, anti-Vietnam War individuals pushing U.S. soldiers to defect from their bases in Munich and Bonn. And because Frank Teruggi was a member of an anti-war solidarity group in Chicago, a letter that he had sent to an individual who was being surveilled in Germany was intercepted, and the FBI wrote a report on him in 1972 that actually had the address of his house in Chile in the report. And the FBI opened a file for him that labeled him subversive. And part of the judge's hypothesis, I think, is that these documents made their way to Chile and were given to the Chileans. We don't know that that actually happened, but I believe that is his hypothesis.
How does the U.S. complicity in murders of U.S. citizens 40 years ago in Chile relate to the current U.S. program that uses unmanned aerial weaponized drones to target U.S. citizens alleged to be involved in terrorist activity today as an example, one of those U.S. citizens killed was Anwar al-Awlaki and his son, both assassinated by drones in Yemen. What are the lessons we can learn?
Well, you know, your listeners will be interested to know that the very first major debate over targeted assassination came, you know, as kind of in the aftermath of the revelations over the U.S. role in Chile in the mid-1970s. A special Senate committee did a special report called Alleged Assassination Plots Against Foreign Leaders. And there was a whole chapter on this assassination sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, of a Chilean general, the chairman of the Chilean Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, it would be the equivalent of assassinating the top general who runs our Joint Chiefs of Staff right here in Washington. And that was what was done in Chile. Why? Because he stood up for the Constitution and said Salvador Allende was duly democratically elected, and I'm not going to order my troops to overthrow him or block his inauguration or ratification as president. And for that, he was targeted by the CIA and eventually murdered. One of the things that came out of the scandal over Chile and the assassination of Rene Schneider and others was a kind of a mandate by the U.S. Senate that presidents step up and take responsibility for covert operations. And so now all covert operations, the president has to send a report to Congress saying that he has authorized them. And in the case of these drone attacks, we know that, in fact, they are made off of a list that the president of the United States actually approves. So President Obama is responsible in the end. The buck stops with him on these murders, not only of U.S. citizens by drones, but all the casualties that have been committed by drones, which number in the hundreds and thousands at this point. And whether he will ever be held accountable because his signature is on the authorization is up to the human rights movement and the sense of justice and indignation the American public feels. We're operating in a post-9/11 world, and eventually we will get back to the moral compass of our country. We'll look again at Chile, and we'll see what country we want to be, and programs like the drone assassination program will be debated in a different way.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Learn more about the Chilean court ruling and U.S. support for the 1973 coup in Chile by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Belinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.